103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. If you want to get in touch with the programme, email mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. On today's programme, I'm going to be looking at social exclusion, social inclusion, and how that all works. Later in the programme, I'll be heading along to an All-Ireland Social Inclusion Forum that was set up just last week in Trinity College, and I'll be chatting to a few people over there, including former Governor of Mountjoy Prison, John Lonergan, and that's all coming up in about 10 minutes' time. But the programme is all about social inclusion and social exclusion today. And first off, joining me on the line is Jennifer Grundulis, a speech and language therapist. And good afternoon, Jennifer.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Tell me how speech and language therapy kind of interacts with social inclusion. First off, maybe, what is social inclusion?
Well, basically, at the bare minimum, social inclusion is basically the ability for all people to take part in society and to fully take part in society. Very frequently, people with disabilities, including people with communication disorders, don't have the ability to access inclusive environments and are often socially excluded because of those communication needs.
So if you're not able to speak it, you're probably going to kind of stay quiet at the back and not being able, wouldn't be able to get involved in something.
Yes, the thing with communication is it's not just about talking, but it's about understanding, and it's about social skills and reading the social rules and be able to form your thoughts in your head before you speak, as well as possibly having a stammer or having not being understood because your speech is impaired from the sounds that you're making. So there's lots of different things that could be impacting your ability to communicate. People with Parkinson's, per se, they often have a hard time being understood, and their bodies are so unfamiliar and unstable. I'm sorry. So they would often, their bodies would stop working, and they would be frozen and not be able to move and leave their house. So because they're not leaving their house because they're not sure when their meds are going to work, they are, in essence, stuck in their home. So even just the aspect of getting out of the house to be able to be included can be a barrier for some people with communication disorders.
So that's the exclusion and how it happens. So the inclusion is to work with them through your disciplines and skills. And how does it actually work? What do you do with people to get them more able to be included with everybody else in society?
Well, there's a lot of different things you can do. One is accessing speech and language therapy to help you to be able to communicate better. Using play therapy as well to help with, for children who have, say, social anxiety challenges or have challenges with working with other children and working together and building on your social skills. That's a really huge aspect to being included and even being in a school and not being bullied, to be able to speak up for yourself when you feel that something isn't right. And to have the speech and language therapist behind you to help you to be confident in your communication. That is a huge aspect of being able to live a positive and mentally well-thinking life, I suppose. And I think one thing that we need to look at from a structural level is continuing to invest in early intervention, trying to identify children who have communication disorders, who have developmental language disorder, autism, and supporting children, say, even with Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, children who stammer as early as possible so that they're getting all the supports they need so that in the long run, they don't find themselves excluded socially. With that, also increased supports for, say, the allied health professionals, not just speech and language therapists, but OTs, physios, therapists of all genres, even looking at neurology and supporting people who need neurology appointments. Having access to these basic supports can help you in your long run. From a more practical level, I think in some ways we need to look at society as well, looking at the person walking down the street and squashing our judgmental voice. Because often the first thing when we see somebody, we make a judgment call on them. And then we need to get rid of that first thought and go to the second thought. When you see somebody walking down the road and they're stumbling and you go, oh, look at that alcoholic, look at that drunk person. Well, let's squash that thought and go, maybe this person has Parkinson's. Maybe this person has cerebral palsy. This child is not being rude. Maybe they have social anxiety. So let's find ways of including these people on our own level and thinking for ourselves, what can we do to help support people?
Very good. Go to the second thought rather than that first initial impression
absolutely.
That you get visually within microseconds. We go back quite a bit through a mutual friend of ours, and I know that in the past it was very difficult to access these services that you're talking about. Have things improved over the decades?
There is still quite a long waiting list to receive intervention in many parts of the country, unfortunately. The therapists on the ground are doing as much as they can to get the services out there to the people. But I would still call on the ministers to continue to increase funding to allow more therapists to be hired, to give a greater and a broader range of services. We now have speech and language therapists through the HSE who are working in the schools. There are projects where the therapists are working in the schools now and trying to support children accessing the services in a different way. But these are still fairly new, so hopefully we'll see that the outcomes for these are very positive and that we'll see more of this type of intervention.
Can I just say that you, it seems to me, sleep, eat and drink social inclusion and speech and language therapy, because when you finish the day job, you go to the night job, which is in a choir where you are working. Tell us a bit about your work in choirs.
Yes, my night job is the choir director for the Move for Parkinson's Voices of Hope Choir. This is a social enterprise, Move for Parkinson's, that was created approximately 7-8 years ago. The choir has been around for 6 years, and it was created to support and give hope to people with Parkinson's. Many people with Parkinson's disease do feel socially excluded because when your body isn't working well, you don't want to leave your home because you're not sure if you're going to sit down at a cafe and then not be able to stand up. So you don't leave your home. So having organizations like Move for Parkinson's and having these choirs, as well as set dancing classes that we do, encourage people with Parkinson's to leave their home on a weekly basis, to meet other people with Parkinson's. We also have people in our choirs, the family members and friends as well. So it's a more inclusive environment. People with Parkinson's often feel very comfortable at our events because there's so many people there like them. So they don't have to worry about if they're having a tremor or if their meds go off and they are not able to move, because everybody there gets it.
I could ask you, are they any good? And of course you would say that they are. Let's prove it by having a listen. This is the Move for Parkinson's Choir singing Labby Siffre's Something Inside So Strong.
The more you refuse to hear my voice,
inside so strong.
The move for Parkinson's Choir and Something Inside So Strongly with Mental Wealth on 103.2 Dublin City FM. On the line with me is Jennifer Grundless, a speech and language therapist and the director of the choir Move for Parkinson's. They are really good. You're doing great work with them there. Can you just, in kind of conclusion, tell us what's next in the area of speech and language therapy? Is there going to be a movement towards getting more people involved and getting people quicker access? What is the next thing that kind of people are campaigning or championing for?
I think from a speech and language therapy point of view, we are always campaigning for more supports for our profession. The Irish Association of Speech and Language Therapists would be very active in supporting speech and language therapists throughout Ireland. And they are great support for if you're looking for more information about the field of speech and language therapy in Ireland. From a ground perspective, what we're looking at from social inclusion are organizations that are promoting social inclusion from the ground up, such as Walk in Drimna, which is a social enterprise that supports the continued education and learning of people with intellectual disabilities, such as Move for Parkinson's, which is encouraging people to come out of their homes and engage in activities that are promoting well-being, such as PayPal, who hire people with disabilities and support them. So, you know, to have a call to organizations to even hire people who have special needs, and showing the value that people with special needs have, and that there is a role and a place for everybody in society. And we need to think of people as human beings, first of all, and not look at the disability, but look at how we can include everybody to be as full members of society as possible.
Brilliant. And I know one of those groups that you mentioned, Walk in, I think they're on the green in Walkinstown, number 12, and there's a cafe there, and the staff are just wonderful, and the coffee and cakes are just
sublime. They're gorgeous.
They're too nice. Jennifer, it's been wonderful having you on the phone, and season's greetings to you and your choir and everyone you work with. Have you got any gigs coming up that you want to plug?
Well, let's see. We had one on Saturday, but this coming Thursday, the graduate in Killiney, we are going to be busking, singing for our supper, I suppose, a bit of a sing-song from 7 to 9. And then the following Sunday, the 16th, if you want your kids to meet Santi, he'll be arriving at the graduate in Killiney, I believe at 2 o'clock with the Santa's Grotto. All the proceeds going to Move for Parkinson's, and he's coming on a fire engine, which is pretty exciting.
Sounds wonderful, and as we heard, they do sound wonderful on the radio. Jennifer Grundless, thank you very much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Jennifer, who works at CATS Ireland, that's CATTS Ireland.com. She also asked me to mention the Irish Association of Speech and Language Therapists, and they're at IASLT.ie. Also to mention the Independent Speech and Language Therapists of Ireland, who are at isti.ie. On Thursday last, I headed along to Trinity College in Dublin. A new forum has been set up for social inclusion for all of Ireland. I spoke with Maxine Radcliffe, one of the organisers, John Lonergan, the former governor of Mountjoy Prison, and first I spoke with one of the organisers, Cliona Ní Chealaigh. I'm with one of the organisers of the forum that has been set up to bring inclusion to all of Ireland. That's part of its title. Cliona Ní Chealaigh from St James's Hospital. Tell us what your role is, what you work at.
So I'm a consultant in James's Hospital and a researcher, and I work predominantly with people who are homeless or otherwise socially excluded. There are at least 1 in 10 of the people that we see in the hospital, so it's a big proportion of the people that we see, and sometimes they might need a little bit of extra kindness, extra time. So that's what we try and do.
This is all about inclusion, which comes from social exclusion. One of your slides pointed out that if you are in a bracket of exclusion, you're 12 times more likely to die this year. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so if you look at a socially excluded woman who's the same age as somebody who isn't, she's 12 times more likely to die in the next year. And that's the same in the UK, the US, Ireland, everywhere that you look. And I think it's such a stark example of something that we're really only now realising, which is this such a dramatic effect of being socially excluded on people's health.
You also said something, hopefully I've got this right, that it's not necessarily about people's choices, that people end up in prison or in certain situations of homelessness or drug addiction because of bad choices. You were taught that, but it's not necessarily that. Tell me what you've found.
So, yeah, I think, you know, our society tends to see those things as choices, and that's pretty much the way we would have been taught it. But if you look at the likelihood of somebody growing up, say, in a family where there's a lot of domestic violence, the dad may be in and out of prison, what's the likelihood of a child in that family when they're born ending up addicted to drugs or in prison compared to somebody who's born into a stable family? The odds are hugely, hugely, hugely skewed for that person who has the more disadvantaged start to do what we perceive as making bad choices. I think addiction to drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, it's often what people do in an effort to keep on, you know, difficult thoughts, difficult emotions from overwhelming them. And it can be a response to either trauma in childhood or mental illness that they're trying to cope with as best they can. But unfortunately, that way of coping has serious knock-on effects for their health.
You're working at the coalface, and it's probably from the difficulties you're finding down on the ground, on the wards, is why you've set this up. Am I right? How bad is it out there?
It's the bulk of what we do. There's the vast majority of patients who I see in general medicine in James's have illnesses related to addiction, and usually that addiction is driven by social exclusion. So the vast majority of people in an acute hospital like James's will have some social reason why they've ended up there.
And how are we going to beat this?
Together. So it's not a job that one person can do. It's not something that one person's skill set can do. It's not just health, it's housing, it's education, it's early childhood, it's prisons. But I think we need to realise that it's one person that's tracking through all those different stages. That's the same person who was a child, who was in foster care, who's now in the hospital, and tomorrow they're in prison. So we just need to join up and address it together.
This is for practitioners and people who are interested in this topic should get in touch. It's for charities, it's for state bodies to get involved. Where do they get in touch? How can people contact you?
So the email address is inclusionhealth@tcd.ie, or inclusionhealth.net is our website. And we're totally open doors. If you're interested in joining or coming along, you're most welcome.
You're one of the keynote speakers. I'm talking with John Lonergan, former governor of Mountjoy. Everyone brings you in and talks as former governor. What are you doing with yourself these days?
I've kept busy enough, really. I'm lucky enough to have lots of invitations like tonight. I go to a lot of schools, talking to secondary, particularly grade students from transition year upwards. I talk a lot to parents because I've been doing a little parenting talk for about 25 years. I find that very useful. It's sharing my own experience, probably, and maybe I could even say wisdom of after rearing my own family and having experience of the prison, and being able to share some of that and highlighting the things that really matter as parenting for parents. So I'm kept busy enough and I keep fit. And I have great health, thanks, touch wood, and that enables me to be still very active.
Brilliant. From my notes, from your keynote, you say that exclusion, social exclusion, and the lack of inclusion can begin with self-worth.
Well, I believe that one of the first major consequences of social exclusion is the lowering of self-worth, or almost the elimination of it. I'd go so far as to say that people don't feel of any value. They're not treated and respected as having any value in society. They're not connected into mainstream society. They feel alienated and excluded, and that has a major consequence for them in terms of how they feel about themselves. And if you don't feel good about yourself, well, then you're really in trouble, because everything that happens to you is acceptable, and you don't necessarily have the fight or the spirit to challenge and to fight back.
The kind of self-worth that's lacking, where is it found? Where can it be? It can't be purchased down the local shop. How do we instill that into young people?
It's all about encouraging them, praising them, giving them looking for the positives in them, looking for the gifts they have. And every human being, in my view, has a special and unique gift. It's about that. It's about encouraging them. It's about giving them recognition. It's about listening to what they have to say, and it's about taking note of what they have to say and showing that you do genuinely. You know, if we are an inclusive society, then we have to be a tolerant society, and that means that we tolerate people, even those who we disagree with. We accept their right to be who they are, and for me that's the fundamental thing. It's not what I want them to do, it's what they want to do themselves, and we should be able to facilitate them to do that.
You said you can't force change. Tell us about that.
Social change, no, you cannot force it. You can make people agree, and you can make people to consent to things, but if their hearts aren't in it and their minds aren't in it. So the real change I'm talking about is the change that comes from within. But what you can do is you can nurture it, you can lead it, and you can encourage it. But at the end of the day, you have to respect the individual person to have the right to control his or her life. And that's what I mean. So if somebody wants to remain homeless, I don't have any difficulty with that, as long as that's their decision, and as long as then that they're given every support and respect during that period. I don't think I have the right to force people into houses. If they don't want to go into houses, that's their right. But I have a responsibility to ensure that they have every option available to them, and whatever option they take, that I support that. That's the principle of a republic, that we respect each and every individual as an individual.
It is going to be my next question with regard to us being a young state, but we're like coming up on 100 years old young state, 102 years after the proclamation, which had those wonderful words about equality and treating everyone equally. We're way far from it, aren't we?
Yeah, or miles. It's not even on the horizon at the moment. As a matter of fact, as I said tonight, I think it exacerbated, it got worse in the last 5 or 6 years again, after the consequences of the Celtic Tiger collapse. Poorer areas got savage cuts in proportion to where they were at, and the loss of those resources and facilities, like youth work and facilities and public health nurses and all the sort of infrastructure that they absolutely are essential, they were all cut back, and the consequences of that. So the gap is widening, and we have thousands, as I said tonight, the hidden poverty, which is the stuff that I'm really concerned about. We have thousands of children in Ireland today that will never reach their potential, and that means that the proclamation is just pie in the sky for them.
I'm with Maxine Radcliffe, one of the organisers of the All-Ireland Inclusion Forum that's begun here in Dublin today. Tell us, what was it that brought you to come up with this idea and bring people to the forum tonight? About 150 people in on the seats.
So I've come from working in homelessness in London, which has a much larger presenting problem, in that there's maybe 3,000 rough sleepers. Dublin has maybe 100 rough sleepers, but I'm really struck by the need for a community of practice here for both homeless health clinicians and housing outreach workers. We need to develop a much more integrated model of working and a supportive community of practice. So that was the inspiration for this. I've been lucky enough to have that in London, where I was part of the London Network of Nurses and Midwives and the Pathway Forum, and I think Ireland would really benefit from having that, so I was wanting to support that in any way. That's what drove us to organise it.
You're here a couple of months. What's your observations from an outsider's view of our homelessness situation?
The thing I'm really struck by is everyone I'm working with, their passion in the field. Everyone's very prepared to go the extra mile. There is a really big difference in that homelessness in London is organised, or services in London are organised in a much more formally structured way because of legislation. And the one thing I would feel is that there are some gaps in legislation here, certainly around safeguarding and priority need. In the UK, if you are homeless with children, then you're escalated in housing terms. And I'm not 100% clear on how that works here yet, but that's a gap that I would see that will need to be addressed.
I'm going to put you on the spot, but is social exclusion something that can be measured? Is the Economic and Social Research Institute or the Central Statistics Office able to put a number on where people stand? Are these numbers attainable?
It's hard to measure. Michael Marmot did a fabulous piece of research. So he's a very eminent professor in London, and he looked at the tube line in London. And as you travel from east to west, from East London, you lose a year of life expectancy. He's demonstrated this really well with a detailed model. And I think that it's really striking to me. You can look at quality of life, which is qualies and dallies. So the WHO have a measure. And the average life expectancy of a homeless woman in Dublin is 38 years old. I don't know what it is for the housed population in Dublin. I would guess it's somewhere in the 70s and 80s. That's a disparity of conservatively 40 years. So what does 40 years of life cost? There is a way of costing that. The WHO have invented that. That's qualies and dallies. I don't know what that sum comes out at, but it's a lot of money and it's a lot of pain for a lot of people.
Final question. When I'm watching television and there's these health dramas like Casualty or ER, the nurses get involved in cases like detectives. Yeah. And you mentioned tonight that that's actually quite true. It annoys me when they do that. But is that what you find nursing can be quite... You didn't go to kind of police college to become a detective, but you do a lot of detective work.
Absolutely, because we have to spend time understanding people, and people say things in words, and they also say an awful lot with their bodies, and there's an awful lot when you look at them about how they present. Nurses are the glue that holds the whole health and social care system together. We pull everything into one kind of central point, and without us, it doesn't work. But you have to be very observant to do that, and that's a central part of being a good detective.
You set up a website. If people want to get in touch, where can they go?
They can go to inclusionhealth.net and they can sign up to our mailing list, and we'll have the audio and visual recording from today's event up there as well shortly, probably within the next 48 to 36 hours.
Maxine Radcliffe, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Nurses are the glue that holds the whole health and social care system together. What a wonderful way of putting it. Maxine Radcliffe, John Lonergan and Cliona Ní Chealaigh from the All-Ireland Inclusion Forum that was set up last Thursday. You can get in touch with them at inclusionhealth.net on the web and inclusionhealth@tcd.ie on the email. This has been Mental Wealth on 103.2 Dublin City FM. From myself, Brian Green, until next Tuesday at the same time, take care, have a safe week. Bye-bye.